KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Harvard's president tells NPR that President Trump's attacks against the university are hurting the country, stopping the school from finishing research the federal government wants done. We hear from him on Morning Edition from NPR News. King Charles is in Canada opening a new session of Parliament today. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. It's the first time a British monarch has done that in decades. What message is that meant to send to President Trump? Also, civil war has ravaged Sudan. We take a look at the sorry state of hospitals in the capital. It's Tuesday, May 27th. On this day in 1994 was a final broadcast of the Larry King Show on the radio and the Arsenio Hall Show on late night television. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he will suspend his 50% tariffs on imported products from the European Union, at least until early July. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports Trump had only introduced the surprisingly high tariff rate on the EU last week.
On Friday, he floated the idea of 50% tariffs on EU goods starting June 1st. Sunday, after EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said she had spoken to Trump, he posted that he had agreed to postpone the tariffs to July 9th. Now he has written on social media that he was, quote, extremely satisfied with a 50% tariff, adding he will set rates if he and the EU are unable to make a deal. Trump added that the EU has now reached out to set dates to negotiate tariff rates. His deadlines for tariffs on China and many other countries will come this summer. If deals are not reached by those dates, tariffs are set to ratchet upward. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
NPR has learned the Trump administration is asking federal agencies to cancel their remaining federal contracts with Harvard University. That's reportedly worth about $100 million. The Trump administration claims Harvard engages in anti-Semitism. The university has denied this and says cutting funding will cut essential healthcare research. NPR and three Colorado public radio stations have filed suit in federal court against the Trump administration today. This is over the president's recent executive order purportedly barring the use of congressionally appropriated funding for NPR and PBS. NPR's David Folkenflik has more.
The lawsuit says that the president's order on May 1st seeking to strip essentially NPR and PBS of all federal funds is unconstitutional, and that it's a violation of free speech and First Amendment protections because the government is seeking to retaliate against the two national public broadcasters for their coverage.
NPR's David Folkenflik reporting. The White House has not released an immediate response to the lawsuit. The number of mothers with mental health struggles has increased in recent years. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports that's according to a new study in JAMA Internal Medicine.
Researchers looked at data from nearly 200,000 mothers of kids under 18 who participated in the National Survey of Children's Health. Mothers reporting excellent mental health declined from 38% in 2016 to 26% in 2023. And mothers who said their mental health was fair or poor increased during this time. Study author Jamie Daw is at Columbia University.
In 2023, this means about 1 in 12 moms are saying they have fair or poor mental health, where back in 2016, it was about 1 in 20. It's a pretty large increase in a relatively short period of time.
Daw says single mothers and those with children on Medicaid reported poorer mental and physical health. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
This is NPR. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says his agency has yanked COVID-19 vaccines for healthy children and healthy pregnant women from the CDC's recommended immunization schedule. He issued a statement online. This means that many insurance companies may not pay for the shots, and that means millions of children and pregnant women won't be able to obtain COVID vaccines. In Massachusetts, an endurance swimmer has completed a 12-day swim around the island of Martha's Vineyard. As NPR's Vanessa Romo reports, the frigid undertaking was meant to draw attention to the plight of sharks worldwide.
Louis Pugh says he's been swimming about 6.2 miles a day, wearing just a Speedo and a swim cap. The water has been cold and choppy, but that's not new to him. The British South African swimmer has also crossed the North Pole and plunged the depths of Antarctica's icy waters, all to raise awareness about threats to oceans. This time around, he chose Martha's Vineyard because it's where the movie Jaws was filmed. His goal is to bring attention to the dangers sharks face due to overfishing and climate change. The International Union for Conservation of Nature reports 37% of shark species are currently threatened with extinction. On his website, Pugh says sharks are key indicators of ocean health, and a decline in sharks signals a system out of balance. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
Authorities in Liverpool, England say more than 60 people were injured when a motorist drove his car into a crowd of soccer fans yesterday. Several people were badly injured. The driver has been arrested. Liverpool police say there is no evidence this was related to terrorism. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration is asking federal agencies to cancel their remaining federal contracts with Harvard University. The contracts are worth an estimated $100 million. That's according to a senior administration official. The move comes after President Trump's administration banned foreign students from attending the school last week. Harvard sued in response. Over the weekend, President Trump criticized Harvard again. Yesterday, our colleague Steve Inskeep sat down with Harvard President Alan Garber.
We need to be firm in our commitments to what we stand for. And what we stand for, I believe I speak for other universities, is education, pursuit of the truth. When we fail in that, then we can expect to be attacked.
Harvard has been attacked. The Supreme Court ruled its admissions policies discriminated in the name of diversity. Student protests over the Israel-Hamas war prompted the university to investigate anti-Semitism. And a past university president resigned amid accusations of plagiarism. Conservative activists now talk of taking Harvard's money and power, and Harvard essentially argues the administration is trying that, pushing to influence the opinions held by faculty and students. All that is the backdrop for the end of the school year. It's graduation week here at the nation's oldest university, and this green area, Harvard Yard, which is surrounded by brick and stone buildings, is covered with tables and chairs for graduation events. We see people lining up to take their photos in front of the John Harvard statue. We've seen people in graduation gowns, but this is a graduation like no other in Harvard's history because of the tremendous pressure put on Harvard by the Trump administration, which we're here to discuss with Harvard's president. That president is a native of Rock Island, Illinois. He obtained 3 Harvard degrees before becoming a medical doctor and professor. Alan Garber is also Jewish, which is relevant given the accusations against the school. And he came into office with his own critique of campus culture. But Garber has now sued the administration twice. In your lawsuit, the most recent of your lawsuits about this, you argue very quickly that this isn't really about international students, that it's an act of retaliation. What is really going on in your view?
In my view, the federal government is saying that we need to address anti-Semitism in particular, but it has raised other issues. And it includes claims that we lack viewpoint diversity. We have been very clear that we think we do have issues, and I would particularly emphasize the speech issues. We think it's a real problem if, particularly at research universities, students don't feel free to speak their minds. When faculty feel that they have to think twice before they talk about the subjects that they're teaching, that's a real problem. And the administration and others have said conservatives are too few on campus and their views are not welcome. And so far as that's true, that's a problem we really need to address.
Is it true?
We have heard from some people that they do feel that way. What is perplexing is the measures that they have taken to address these that don't even hit the same people that they believe are causing the problems. Why cut off research funding? Sure, it hurts Harvard, but it hurts the country because after all, the research funding, it's not a gift. The research funding is given to universities and other research institutions to carry out work that the federal government designates as high priority work. It is work that they want done. Shutting off that work does not help the country, even as it punishes Harvard. And it is hard to see the link between that and, say, anti-Semitism.
Is the administration trying to damage, destroy, or capture your university?
I don't know fully what the motivations are, but I do know that there are people who are fighting a cultural battle. They don't like what's happened to campuses, and sometimes they don't like what we represent. What I can tell you is Harvard is a very old institution, much older than the country. And as long as there has been a United States of America, Harvard has thought that its role is to serve the nation. And that is why, insofar as there are people who would like to see these universities brought down in some sense, I think that their fire is misdirected, because we have a common interest in making the nation, and indeed the world, a better place.
In the letter cutting off your ability to host international students, the Department of Homeland Security made a number of accusations, including these, that you, Harvard, brazenly refused to provide information that was demanded about international students, and that you also, quote, ignored a follow-up question about them. Is either of those statements true?
To the best of my knowledge, they are not true. I need to add, by the way, that this is clearly the subject of litigation. So we have endeavored to comply fully in line with the law with the requests that the government has made.
In that same statement, announcing that you would lose the right to host international students, the DHS was able to link to one of Harvard's own documents. And I read through the document. There are a lot of accusations in there about things that have gone wrong here. And my eye fell on one sentence, which I wrote down. I'll quote it to you. Since fall 2023, different factions at Harvard have fought to force various university leaders to make statements, invest, divest, hire, fire, dox, undox, discipline students, and undiscipline them. How would you define the problem?
Well, clearly there has been tremendous division on campus over that period of time. But the main purpose of that report was to identify the problems that we face, particularly with regard to our Jewish and Israeli students.
President Garber says the university task force did find very real cultural problems.
The main manifestation of anti-Semitism and anti-Israeli bias that we have grappled with has to do with social exclusion. It has to do with shunning. If a student sits down at a dining room table and they have good conversations with other students who don't know them, and when the other students find out that that student is Israeli, if they refuse to continue to speak to them, we have a serious problem that we need to address.
In our conversation, the Harvard president argued that the university has taken measures to encourage a more respectful exchange of ideas. He suggested that's one reason the school year now ending was more peaceful than the year before.
We shouldn't be in an echo chamber. Everyone in our community needs to hear other views. And let me add, that's one reason why it is so important for us to be able to have international students on our campus. There is so much that they contribute to our environment, and they enable everyone else to open their minds.
You argue that it's a benefit for U.S.-born students to have the international students here?
Absolutely. Harvard is an American institution that is engaged globally, and I wouldn't want to change that. It's in the interest of the university. It's in the interest of the nation.
What would you say to someone in the middle of the country, where I come from, where you come from, who is listening to us and maybe thinking, I really don't have a stake in this. I didn't go to Harvard. I'm not sending my kid to Harvard. I really don't like Harvard that much. And Harvard deserves what they're getting, or in any case, it doesn't matter much to me. What would you say to somebody who has that attitude?
I would ask them to learn a little bit more, not only about Harvard, but about universities like Harvard, that is research universities. There are so many discoveries that have come from Harvard and other research universities. Advances in cancer, in treatments of cancer of all kinds. A faculty member of ours just got the breakthrough prize for work that led to the discovery of GLP-1 drugs, which are now revolutionizing how we approach obesity, diabetes, and many other conditions. Another one of our faculty received the breakthrough prize this year for advances in gene editing, which is already being used to cure diseases. This is a huge part of what we do. Everybody benefits from the research work of universities like ours.
When President Trump says, as he did this week, that Harvard's grants ought to go to trade schools instead, how do you respond to that?
I would say that the federal government has the authority through the budgeting process to reallocate funds. But the question to ask is, what problem is he trying to solve by doing that? The money that goes to research universities in the form of grants and contracts, which is almost all of the federal support that we get, is used to pay for work that we perform at the behest of the government. So in reallocating to some other use, including trade schools, it means that work just won't be performed.
One other thing, in reading the DHS, Department of Homeland Security statement about Harvard, there is a line that struck me. They're talking about their actions against Harvard. Let this serve as a warning to all universities and academic institutions across the country. I wonder if you agree with that statement, that this episode is in fact a warning to all universities across the country.
Well, they said it, and I have to believe it, and I've repeated it myself. And that is how it's understood by the other leaders of other universities that I've spoken to. It is a warning. They see this as a message that if you don't comply with what we're demanding, these will be the consequences.
Mr. President, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Alan Garber is the president of Harvard University. We spoke with him at WBUR in Boston. Our conversation was on video, and you can find it at the NPR app, on social media, and elsewhere. This is NPR News. Thank you.
next fresh air. James Patterson, one of the best-selling authors in the world, an estimated 400 million copies of his book sold. That includes the Alex Cross Detective Series, The Women's Murder Club, and Maximum Ride. He's collaborated on novels with Bill Clinton, Dolly Parton, and a starting one with Mr. Beast. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. In just 2 years, civil war has destroyed much of Sudan's health system. The full scale of the humanitarian crisis is coming to light after the Sudanese army recently recaptured the capital, Khartoum, from rebels. Here's NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu with a report that details the harsh conditions faced by children and others.
Before the war, there were nearly 100 hospitals in Khartoum. 2 years on, not a single one is fully functioning. Shut down without access to medical supplies, looted or wrecked by fighting between the Sudanese army and the rapid support forces. We walk over broken glass and concrete at the Ibn Sina Specialized Hospital in Khartoum. The hospital is in ruins, blown apart by artillery and gunfire. Syringes, antibiotics and bullet casing litter the grounds. The government is working to repair and rebuild hospitals like this, but until then, thousands in Khartoum are forced to seek help elsewhere. In places like Al Buluq Pediatric Hospital, across the White Nile River, in Khartoum's twin city of Omdurman. In a packed hospital ward, 30-year-old Aloia Zakaria is cradling her 1-year-old daughter, Saba, in her arms. She's frail and coughing, and all around her are babies in critical condition, their bones and skulls bulging from their skin, their feet and stomach swollen. Zakaria lives in Khartoum, but to reach a functioning hospital, she had to flee the city on foot. She tells me they were surviving on cupfuls of lentils. And when more than a dozen malnourished children in her neighborhood died, she had to leave.
It's getting higher, definitely.
Dr. Ahmed Khologi is the director at Al Buluq. He said the hospital is overwhelmed.
The daily admission were about 50s to 60s, but now we reach 80s and 90s, and last Friday was 100 admissions.
Each bed on this ward is occupied by 2 or sometimes 3 children, and roughly 1 in every 25 children who arrive here don't survive. In the absence of outside help through the war, people in Khartoum have been forced to rely on each other. Community kitchens serve food donated by local people and the diaspora, and doctors provide free basic care. Much of this work is organized by Emergency Response Rooms, a Nobel Peace Prize-nominated network of grassroots volunteers that have become a lifeline. Dua Tariq is one of them.
We provide great kits, we provide, sometimes we take them to clinics, coordinating with our partners in civil society organizations.
But she said often it wasn't enough, and everyone was affected, including the volunteers.
There is this very personal friend. Her name was Auntie Magda, Khaltu Magda. Khaltu Magda was among the first volunteers who volunteered in the emergency response rooms with us. And she was cooking every day for like 1.5 years. She got very sick.
She struggled to eat or drink.
And when I went to see her, I couldn't recognize her. She was just skin and bones. She needed a doctor. No doctor.
And in January, she passed away. In Sudan, hunger is not just a byproduct of war, it's a weapon. Both sides are accused of blocking aid. More than 600,000 people are suffering from famine, according to the UN. Aid is finally now trickling into Khartoum, but there are new threats. While the RSF loses ground, it has launched drone strikes on civilian areas, especially in Port Sudan, the temporary capital and crucially the main entry point for humanitarian aid. Back at Al Bulook Hospital, doctors say one-year-old Saba is responding to treatment and she's gaining weight. And it was Zakaria's courage that saved her. She says on her journey here, she had to pass areas of active conflict. Then she was blocked by several RSF checkpoints. She was slapped, beaten, and robbed of her phone and her money. But eventually, she was let through. She walked for more than 4 hours until she made it here. Emmanuel Akimotu, NPR News, Khartoum.
Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker Marcel Ofuls has died. He was 97 years old. His best-known work was the 1969 film The Sorrow and the Pity, which documented the Nazi occupation of France. Ofuls and his family had fled Germany to escape the Nazis. They landed in Hollywood. There, his father, Max Ofuls, continued as a filmmaker, and Marcel became a leading chronicler of 20th century atrocities. Howie Mavshevitz of member station KUNC has this appreciation.
The films of Marcel Ofuls are among the basic moral documents of the movies. In The Sorrow and the Pity, Ofuls interviews former Nazis, members of the resistance, and average people who simply found ways to get by. The movie is more than 4 hours long.
The excuse I give myself, which is not always a good excuse, is that I think there's a relationship between attention span and morality.
Marcel Ofuls from a 1978 NPR interview.
I think that if you shorten people's attention span a great deal, you are left with only the attraction of power and the power of power.
Ofuls demanded and managed to command his audience's attention. And The Sorrow and the Pity became an art house hit, says Pat Ofterheide, who teaches communications at American University in Washington, D.C.
It's a kind of filmmaking where the filmmaker is very present as an investigator into something about the human condition.
Ofuls was good at putting old Nazis and retired U.S. intelligence workers at their ease, as he does in his 1988 documentary, Hotel Terminus, about the notorious Klaus Barbie and the Americans who later protected him.
You are familiar with the term the rat line?
No, that is a misnomer. Yeah,
but you've heard the term.
Yes.
The function of documentaries, if they still have a function, is to be an antidote not so much to fiction filmmaking as to the news.
Ofuls told NPR in 1992 that in putting his films together, subjectivity was key.
To be able to reflect together and to juxtapose events and people in such a way that individual destinies and collective destinies make us think and reflect about our own roles in life. The best way to do that, I think, is to be subjective and to go in the direction of film essays.
His mission was more than entertainment. He wanted to make the world a better place. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mavshevitz.
This is NPR News.
Remember that big recall of deli meat last year? Food safety experts say it could happen again.
Do I foresee another boar's head situation? Absolutely. I worry about the public.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Federal job cuts mean fewer people now working in inspections and testing, putting the safety of everything we eat at risk. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Trump administration is directing federal agencies to cancel their remaining federal contracts with Harvard University, according to a senior administration official. An estimated $100 million on the line. The government's accusing the Ivy League school of being complicit in anti-Semitic, anti-American activities on campus. It's demanding a list of Harvard's foreign students, alarming students like Waleed Akef of Egypt.
We're all panicking. We're all overwhelmed. Time of uncertainty, literally, like it's, I've never experienced it before.
The president of Harvard tells NPR that institutions also in Trump's crosshairs need to defend what they stand for. While prospects for a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas remain tenuous, NPR's Daniel Lestrin reports hunger across Gaza is extreme, and the new U.S.-backed group tasked with getting food to the Palestinian people is facing growing criticism from the U.N.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation is a new entity. It involves American contractors. And instead of having food distributed in hundreds of points across Gaza, this group is going to be restricting that to four new zones, with Israeli soldiers guarding the perimeter and private contractors giving out boxes of food to families that are supposed to last once a week.
NPR's Daniel Lestrin reporting. U.S. stocks trading higher this hour. The Dow is up 551 points, or more than 1%. This is NPR News. A study published in Nature reveals new genetic data that monkeypox was circulating undetected in people in West Africa for years before its 2022 outbreak. NPR's Gabriela Manuel has details.
Historically, mpox has been something that people got when they came into contact with certain small animals in West Africa. But not much was known about exactly when it started spreading readily from person to person. Now, international researchers have pooled their mpox samples and analyzed the genetics. They found that one type of the virus likely first started circulating among humans in August 2014 in Nigeria. That's 3 years before it was detected and 8 years before it spread globally. Study authors say better disease surveillance in Africa and better treatment could have prevented the international outbreak. Gabriela Emanuel, NPR News.
King Charles is marking the opening session of Canada's Parliament with a throne speech. He's the first head of state to do so since his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, in 1977.
It is with a deep sense of pride and pleasure that my wife and I join you here today as we witness Canadians coming together in a renewed sense of national pride, unity, and hope.
Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney says the British monarch's visit underscores the country's sovereignty. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Me, Martinez, in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump says weekend negotiations for a new nuclear deal with Iran were, in his words, very good. Key U.S. allies in the Persian Gulf states want Trump to make a deal, as the president heard during his tour of the region earlier this month. NPR's international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam has this report.
President Trump was welcomed with plenty of pomp during his four-day swing through Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE, where he mixed business deals with diplomacy. The one topic that came up again and again was Iran.
My understanding is that every leader that President Trump met in his visit to the Gulf region urged him to do a deal with Iran and resolve the standoff with the Iranians diplomatically.
Ali Vayaz directs the Iran project at the International Crisis Group. He says this is a far cry from Trump's first term in office when the Gulf nations were adamantly against a deal with Iran. But the conflicts across the region since then have put the wealthy Gulf states on edge.
This time is very different, and the reason is they know that if there is no deal with Iran and the nuclear standoff comes to a head, that they would become collateral damage in any serious confrontation between Iran and the United States.
Trump has said he wants to give negotiations with Iran a chance, but has warned he'll back military action if an agreement isn't reached soon. Wendy Sherman was lead U.S. negotiator for the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran under President Obama. She says it's unclear what Trump's goal is, for Iran to completely give up its nuclear program, something Tehran says it will never do, or allow Iran to enrich just enough uranium for civilian use. Sherman says that's facing opposition from senior administration officials and Congress.
Virtually every Republican senator has sent a letter saying it must be complete dismantlement of the program, but I don't think that's where President Trump is. I think he wants a deal, but this constant changing the goalposts is not helpful.
Trump has already crossed a red line with Congress. While in Riyadh, he held a surprising meeting with Syria's new president, Ahmed al-Shara, formerly on the U.S. terror list, and vowed to end nearly five decades of sanctions on Syria. Isfandiar Batmanghelidj is the CEO of Borsan Bazaar, a London-based economic think tank. He says Trump's move could give Tehran hope, despite Shiraz's antipathy to Iran.
The fact that Trump would be willing to take that stance very publicly and say, we're going to lift these sanctions, shows that he's willing to put his own political capital on the line to make transformative moves in the region.
Batmanghelidj says Iran likely wants to make a deal. Its economy is crumbling under the weight of sanctions. There are energy shortages, and proxies in the region have been decimated by Israel. After years of no interaction, the U.S. and Iran have now held four meetings in just over a month. Batmanghelidj says the pace is striking.
The Iranians seem to understand that you need to keep Trump's attention and you need to keep the feeling that the negotiations are moving forward. We also see the Iranian administration being very kind of proactive in signaling their willingness to have a very new relationship with the United States.
The International Crisis Group's Ali Vayaz says one way Iran could sweeten the deal for a transactional president would be to offer Iran as a possible destination for U.S. investors.
Resource-rich authoritarian states are attractive for President Trump, and you see Iranian foreign minister reiterating the concept of opening the Iranian market to American companies as means of basically attracting President Trump's attention.
But like everything else in the negotiations, that would require a level of compromise, and there's no guarantee that will happen. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
King Charles is in Canada today to open the new session of Parliament. It's the first time a British monarch has done that in decades. For more on this unusual visit from the King, journalist Emma Jacobs joins us now from Montreal. Emma, King Charles still gets treatment for his cancer that was diagnosed last year. Why is he in Canada?
Canada's new Prime Minister Mark Carney invited King Charles. He is the symbolic head of state of Canada. As you said, he has been under cancer treatment back home in the UK for over a year and been on a limited work schedule. So this is unusual timing, but it is his first visit to Canada as king since his coronation in 2023. And it's been many years, in fact, almost 50 years since a British monarch has delivered what's called a speech from the throne. The last time was Charles's mother, the late Queen Elizabeth II, in 1977. The second reason that he's making this visit, and it's unusual, is the context. In recent months, there's been a lot of talk and concern here in Canada about U.S. President Donald Trump's interest in incorporating Canada as the 51st state. Prime Minister Carney has vehemently rejected this idea. And today, by opening the parliament in the capital, Ottawa, King Charles is making a show of support for Canada's sovereignty.
All right. So what else does King Charles plan during his Canadian visit?
So the king and his wife, Queen Camilla, arrived in Ottawa yesterday, Monday afternoon. Prime Minister Carney welcomed them to the Canadian capital with a series of events, attendees at a tree planting ceremony broke into song with God Save the King. There was also a very Canadian version of the ceremonial first pitch, the king threw out puck for a street hockey game. But the primary focus here is on the king's speech today to open the new session of parliament. It's actually written by the Canadian Prime Minister's office and will lay out the government's policy priorities for this latest legislative session. The king just delivers it, and analysts will scrutinize the symbolism and look for any hint at how Canada will deal with its closest neighbor, the United States.
Now, what has Prime Minister Carney said about the visit?
The Prime Minister released a statement yesterday welcoming the King and Queen to Canada. He called the King's speech to the Senate chamber a, quote, historic honor that matches the weight of our times. And he went on to say it speaks to our enduring tradition and friendship, to the vitality of our constitutional monarchy and our distinct identity, and to the historic ties that crises only fortify. That word crises perhaps signals Carney's assessment of the situation facing Canada today, a radical shift in tone and attitude from its closest neighbor and finding its place in a world that is reordering.
All right, that's journalist Emma Jacobs reporting on King Charles's visit to Canada from Montreal. Emma, thanks.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Randy Rainbow parodies politicians wearing his silly pink glasses. Now he's given those glasses magical powers in a new kids book about bullying. Next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. A Kentucky game warden got a call last month about a bear inside someone's home. It seems the bear climbed up a ladder outside, squeezed through a hole in the attic, and then crashed through the ceiling into the kitchen. The warden said he found the bear just hanging out on top of the stove, scrunched up underneath the exhaust hood. The bear had a much easier time getting out of the house, as the warden was able to just shoo it out an open door. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Archaeologists at the New York State Museum are piecing together a boat found deep in the muck at the site of the former World Trade Center. The boat dates back to the Revolutionary War. It was found 15 years ago and is now getting a permanent home, even though part of its journey to New York remains a mystery. John Campbell of member station WNYC has this report.
A handful of workers are standing at a table in the New York State Museum in Albany. They're in the corner of a big, empty exhibit space, and they're surrounded by planks of old brown wood. One grabs a steamer and sprays some of the timber down. Another uses a Q-tip to carefully clean the muck out of every nook and cranny. On the other side of the room, archaeology student Angela Paola uses a handheld tool to grind away at a piece of foam.
We're currently just trying to get the platform for the keel leveled out. So once the keel is all level, we can actually start building the boat out from there.
She's talking about what's become known as the World Trade Center ship, a wooden boat found 22 feet below the surface at ground zero. The ship has been the talk of archaeologists since its discovery made national news in 2010. Since then, researchers have worked tirelessly to piece together its story. They analyzed rings in the wood grain to figure out it was likely built in Philadelphia in the 1770s, right around the Revolutionary War. And they know it was long buried by 1818, since landfill had turned water into shore by then. But there's still a lot they don't know.
What's the biggest unanswered question that you still have about this?
That button, how did it get into the boat?
That's Dr. Peter Fix, a research scientist at Texas A&M who's reconstructing the ship. He's talking about a small pewter button found in the boat inscribed with the number 52. He remembers chatting about it years ago with a museum curator.
And he said, well, we have this button. And the button is for a British regiment, 52nd a foot. How did that get in there? Then that piqued my brain.
That's about when researchers realized the boat was probably a gunship made for war, not a sloop or a cargo ship like they first thought. That button suggests the British captured it, but we don't know how or when it got to New York City.
How much time do you spend thinking about that button?
Probably too much.
For the next several weeks, Dr. Fix and a team of grad students will continue reconstructing the remnants of the boat for a permanent exhibit in the New York State Museum. Michael Lucas is the museum's historical archaeology curator. He says the public's invited to watch it all happen and ask questions of the people doing the work.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You're not going to have an opportunity to see a 18th-century ship being constructed probably again in your life.
Once the boat is reassembled, the museum plans to make it the center of an exhibit on America's founding. The goal is to have it all ready for the 250th anniversary in 2026. For NPR News, I'm John Campbell in Albany.
The three federal agencies that monitor what we eat are all facing deep cuts, which started even before President Trump's mass staffing cuts. Where does that leave food safety? We'll hear this afternoon on All Things Considered. Listen in the NPR app, on a smart speaker, or ask for your local station by name, or tune in on the radio. This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. A lot of us say we want to eat a more healthy diet, but cutting back on meat or going vegetarian is way easier said than done. But the road to healthy eating doesn't have to include dramatic changes or big sacrifices. You can ease your way into it.
It's really about moving meat a little bit off from the center of the plate, smaller portions of meat, and you don't miss out on any of the comfort.
That's Dan Souza, Chief Content Officer for America's Test Kitchen. He helped me make one of the recipes from their new cookbook, Mostly Meatless. It's a collection of more than 200 dishes for committed vegetarians and those who might be veggie curious.
Many of the recipes include just a small amount of meat that provides tons of flavor and texture to it. I really view this as like exactly how most people want to be cooking nowadays.
I love that because I think that at least I struggle with extremes. So every time I try to cut meat out of my diet, I feel like I go backwards. So the idea that you incorporate it still, but don't make it the center of everything, which I think is how I grew up eating. Like there had to be a protein at the center, a meat protein at the center.
Absolutely. You know, and I think it's true for a lot of people when you set up really rigid rules for yourself and then you don't live up to those rules. It's so easy to sort of backslide and say, well, I'm not doing it perfectly, so I'm not doing it. And this book is about something very achievable and sustainable.
Now, I was in my kitchen in Washington, D.C. Dan was in Boston keeping an eye on me over Zoom as we made rigatoni with mushroom bolognese.
We're going to turn the mushrooms into something that really has the sort of mouthfeel and texture and some of the flavor of meat. So it's not a big slice of mushroom on like a pizza or something like that. It's a little bit more of a stealthy ingredient.
Mushroom, mushrooms, the taste for all seasons. Mushrooms, got a taste of their own.
Now, full disclosure, I have a complicated relationship with mushrooms. I would not touch them as a kid, but I'll eat them now. Turns out I also have a complicated relationship with my food processor, as I discovered when I tried to chop up some mushrooms for the bolognese. I clearly need to replace this thing.
Well, we have a whole reviews team that tests equipment all the time, so if you need a recommendation.
Okay. What's next?
So we're really taking some cues here from a classic bolognese. So that's a long cooked meat sauce. And so we have a small onion, a carrot, and 3 cloves of garlic. And we want to basically chop or mince those. You can do this on your cutting board. You can also use the food processor if that is easier.
I feel like it won't be easier based on our experience. I decided to chop up the vegetables the old-fashioned way with a knife and cutting board. What do you say to people who assume that putting less meat into something and more vegetables is going to just make it less delicious?
So it's really interesting because I think we think of meat as being incredibly meaty, but at the end of the day, a lot of times when we get intense meatiness and savoriness, it's from other ingredients that are included with the meat. So something like, say, a chicken breast is actually pretty mild and pretty plain. But if you marinate it in some soy sauce, you get a little salt and maybe some acid in there, those things amp up the flavor of it intensely. And so you can use those same ingredients and use a much smaller amount of, say, that chicken breast, and you get something that is super savory, super enjoyable. But it's not really about the meat in that instance. I'm cooking up my own.
How much pasta do we do?
We're going to do a pound of rigatoni.
Yep. All
right. So we're going to cook that until it's al dente, so a little bit of bite when you taste it. During this time, while the pasta's cooking, we can start building our sauce. So we're going to heat 3 tablespoons of olive oil in a 12-inch skillet over medium-high heat.
Okay. I was thinking, like, a lot of the times when I eat a vegetarian recipe, I'll feel hungry later. I'm like, okay, I'm ready for dinner again.
I think one of the important things is looking at fiber. Really complex carbohydrates are very slow to digest. They also provide this feeling of fullness for much, much longer.
Them belly full, but we hungry. Hungry mob is a hungry mob.
So you can add the mushrooms, onion, carrot, all into the pan.
Let's just see. Yeah. Right? Put the mushrooms in.
So what we'll do is we'll get a little bit of sticking on there, and that's going to create something that we call fond, sort of the brown bits left behind, and that deep browning is flavor. The fancy term for it is the Maillard browning reactions, but it's essentially when there's like proteins and sugars involved with high heat, you get like hundreds of new flavor compounds and aromas. That browning on the outside is responsible for some of the most flavorful foods that we eat.
Yeah, it really smells good now that the garlic's in there. This does really look like a bolognese with the mushrooms.
I know, isn't that interesting how it does that? We talk about kind of you eat with your eyes before anything else.
True.
I'll saute the onions while you chop up the olives. We'll make enough for us too. For the symphony of flavors that we both can savor. You know this is what we have to do.
Okay, so now we're at the very best part of the recipe, which is the eating part.
Oh, that's my favorite part.
Yes, it's everybody's favorite part.
Usually I start there.
Yeah.
But today, let's try it. I feel like we need a little cheese on top. That's so good.
Cooking and eating mostly meatless lines up with so many different recommendations that we get from experts across the field. It's also a way to eat, in my mind, that just like makes you feel really good. So I think it's perfectly timed for people that maybe have a hard time maybe being completely vegetarian or completely strict under one of these definitions, but really want to cook for themselves in a way that is healthy and sustainable for the long run.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for cooking with me, for guiding me through.
My pleasure. Happy eating.
Dan Souza is Chief Content Officer for America's Test Kitchen. The new book is called Mostly Meatless.
Fried with some butter or even on a barbecue, the one that's got the taste you can't hide. Mushroom.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Layla Faldin.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Mushroom, the taste for all seasons. Mushrooms, got a taste of their own. Mushroom, for so many reasons. The taste sensational, vegetable for all seasons.